Before the war in Ukraine, the previous European war was caused by the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, bringing conflict and bloodshed to the Balkans. In 1999, the village of Krusha and Mada in Kosovo experienced one of the greatest atrocities in the Kosovan War. More than 240 people were killed or went missing when Serbian forces entered the village. Today, some 20 years later, up to 1,600 Kosovans are still missing, 64 of them from that village of Krusha and Mada. Film Hive, from director Blerta Basholi, tells the story of Farij, who lives in this village, experiencing the terrible grief and fading hope that her husband, who disappeared during the massacre, will never return alive. And yet Farij has to fight in order to make a living for herself and her remaining family. Delighted to be joined by Blerta Basholi this evening on the programme. Blerta, congratulations on the film, first of all. This is the story of Farij. It's based on a true story. Where did you actually come across this extraordinary tale, in fact?
Hello, and thank you for having me in your program. I initially heard the story on TV while I was still in US studying for film, and Farije was on TV talking about how what she went through, what happened to her during the war, and how she started a business and how she was prejudiced about it. Initially, I thought it's really interesting story as a story in itself and really wanted to meet Farije. But and the same year, I came back to Kosovo and went to meet her in person. And meeting her in person, it really impressed me. She, like her as a character, as a personality, as a woman, the way she was talking about everything, her attitude, everything about her really was really inspiring, encouraging, and very impressive to me. That it only kind of then became something of a duty for me to portray on a big screen.
So you felt that you had to tell this story. Farija, I hear, is how you're pronouncing it. So I'll try my best to get it close to what you're saying there. She is an extraordinary woman, and as played in the film as well by Ilka Gashi, if I'm saying that name correctly, it's an extraordinary character that we see on the screen in front of us. But give us a sense of her situation in the immediate post-war period in Kosovo.
Her situation immediately after the war was terrible, because she left the village with her children and went to her parents' village, which was closer to the border with Albania, and they thought they were safer. And I think that she also left to Albania. And right after the war, she came back, and she was one of the first people. Her and her father-in-law came back to her houses, and they wanted to search because they thought they may be going to find her husband. And when they came back, they didn't find anybody. Unfortunately, they sometimes only saw corpses, and the houses were burned. So almost all the houses in Krusha and Mada were burned, and they were left nothing. So basically they lost their family members. I mean, she lost her husband and a lot of two other family members, which were her brothers-in-law, and they lost their houses, and they basically had to come back and rebuild everything.
So that's
why for me it was really impressive, because really she literally had to rebuild her life, her house, raised two children, and still deal with the society and still keep searching for her husband, which she still does, because she still doesn't know where he is.
Yeah, I mean, there's an excellent on the missing husband part of the story. There's an absolutely heartbreaking scene in the film where we see her looking at some television footage, and she's just trying to focus in on this one image that may or may not be her husband. It looks like his jacket. I guess that type of search for a missing loved one is exactly what goes on in a post-war situation.
Oh, well, exactly. It is exactly what happened to her. I mean, because I really tried to understand, I witnessed a lot during the war, and I was a teenager during the war in Kosovo. Luckily, I haven't lost anybody. And I was really trying to understand how must it feel to lose someone and not know where they are. And thanks to Farije, we could go a lot of times into very sensitive and deep conversations. And I asked her, how is it? How did you search for him? And then she told me that she saw this video and she thought it was her husband's jacket. And for me, that was really like, I mean, until what point you hope for like getting an information, a jacket that wasn't even clear if it was the right color. She had to search. And then the forensic doctors told me that the clothes that that stay buried for a long time in massive graves, they can lose a little bit the color. So it's even hard to recognize them after they're taken out. These things are really were for me very, very emotional, and wanted to portray that because they did everything. And these families, go through a lot, and they still do, because there's still a lot of missing people in Kosovo. And that's why I keep saying war doesn't benefit anyone, and what's happening in Ukraine is really for us, us really, really hard to witness, because we thought this is not going to happen to anyone anymore.
Even as you described the situation where Fariha and her family went closer to the border with Albania, remove the word Albania there, and we're in exactly the situation that many people are in Ukraine, where they moved closer to the border with Poland, hoping that they would be safer, and they find themselves in that situation. Looking at events in Ukraine, just to move off the film slightly for a moment, that must bring back your own getting out of Kosovo at the time of the war. How difficult was that, or did you get out ahead of things becoming very difficult?
And no, I mean, for me, I didn't get ahead of it. After the NATO started bombing Pristina and then the military points of Serbian army, I live in the capital, and I lived then, and we could see bombing from our kitchen window. And my parents decided that we split, that my mom, my brother and I, and my cousin, who was a boy, and they were both over 18, and we were afraid that the military are going to come and take them and send them to war, or maybe kill them. They decided that we split, and me and my mom and my brother left, and they left. My sisters and my father wanted to leave the next day because they thought if we split, maybe half of the family will be safe somehow. And then they were not allowed to leave Kosovo. Yeah. So when I see Ukrainian people leaving in trains and going to Berlin, because I went to Macedonia, and then we went to Germany as well as refugees, really brings back a lot of memories. And as I said, it's hard to witness, but also I think it's a little bit embarrassing to witness in these times of like social media. We're just watching, even including myself. I think I'm just watching and doing nothing. I'm posting sometimes things, but that doesn't really help them. So I don't know what to say, but for me, it's really sad. It brings a lot of memories, but also it's really, really sad to see it happen, because, you know, war doesn't heal easily, and those who are lost will never be back. So, and people who witness things will never forget them. So I hope it will stop soon.
Yeah, one of the many things that this film of yours will do is give us a hint as to the kind of difficulties that people will experience in a post-war situation. Let's hope we get to a post-war situation. But this is what Hive really deals with. Obviously, there's that, the loss of the husband, that the permanently not knowing about the husband. We might come back to that aspect of things. But let's talk a little bit about the society in which she did find herself. She was lucky in some ways, Fariha, in that her in-laws were relatively liberally minded, in that they didn't just expect a widow should be at home listening to her in-laws cooking food and staying quiet. That was what many of the families in the area would have thought. She was in a slightly different family, but the battle that she had to fight to, even quite simply, when she got a driving license and started to drive, the response to it is extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly. Even for me, it was interesting to hear about. My mom used to drive even before the war, and she worked, but we lived in the city. And if somebody would have told me that a widowed woman in the village needs to work and drive to provide for kids, I would have said the whole village would have helped her, because we worked together before the war. Everybody really helped each other. We were in very difficult situations. Albanians were thrown out of work. And we really, all we did, we like helped each other. People who came to UK to like work for their families would sometimes help other families as well. And And when I witnessed this, I was really also very surprised and wanted to talk about it. I mean, I wanted to talk about the war so that the history doesn't repeat itself. Unfortunately, it is repeating itself. Mm. And also wanted to like talk about women's position. I mean, this woman, what were people expecting her to do? To like sit home and cry? Yes, Fariye had a different situation at home, and that's why I love the grandfather character, yeah, because it is how he was for real. But that was because I didn't have the chance to show it on the film, but he lived abroad. He was a little bit more open-minded. He was caught between his pain for losing his sons and all of that, but he was caught between tradition and wanting to understand her. But at the same time, he was supportive to her in many ways. But other people, I think it was also a post-war society, but we also live in a patriarchal society, and still women are expected to be in certain roles, and more so in rural areas.
Yeah.
And Fahriye broke that kind of thought and those stereotypes. And that's why really it amazes me, because she could just really give up every day, and you couldn't say, why did you give it up? Because she had, I mean, I try to say this, like giving up was knocking on her door every day, and she decided not to. And I'm glad she didn't, because she's just a role model to me and to her daughter, to her son, to her nieces now, because she's a grandmother now, and to many other women who luckily and happily are working together with her.
Yeah,
now.
That aspect of loss and not knowing what to do is there in the grandfather, the father-in-law's story as well. Haksu is his name. Who's the actor who plays that part? Would you say his name for me?
Chun Lai Chi,
who plays that part, and he has to make a decision whether to give DNA of blood so that DNA samples can be got to identify clothing and things like that. And there's a wonderful moment when he has to decide, if he gives this and it proves something, does that mean all hope is gone? That kind of dilemma, that personal emotional dilemma, I found deeply moving, I must say. But one of the really uplifting parts of this then is the fact that Fahisha and the women in the village then start to make this achvar. Now, I'm sure for anybody from Kosova, the words achvar probably are hugely emotive and bring back all sorts of taste memories. Maybe explain what it is, first of all.
It is a bread spread, so you can eat it for a breakfast and put it in a piece of bread and, I don't know, a tea and some cheese, and it really tastes good. And it's something our moms usually would make it, but the whole family would help actually, because it's quite a lot of work, and would make it for winter. It was like put in jars for winter food. But now we're buying it from women like Fahriye. And now, as Fahriye says, men are making aivar too, because a lot of men also who opened the same business in her village and are creating similar products.
Yeah, it's a relish, or a bread spread, as you say, made from peppers and lots of other material, I suppose, and lots of secret family ingredients, I would guess, when it comes to the making of that particular spread. But she has made a business of that for herself, a very successful business. It's an international business now, isn't it?
Yes, and for me, that's what really was also very amazing about her, because she didn't have a chance to go to university, although she wanted to, but she was like, I never imagined myself as a housewife, and nothing wrong with being a housewife, but these women from villages were expected to be housewives. And she was like, I never imagined myself like a housewife. I always wanted to open a business, and maybe even if my husband would have been alive, I would still do something together with him. And for me, it was really smart of her that she used something that all these women did not have any education. I mean, they probably had primary school. Fahriye had also a secondary, like a high school, but none of them went to university or something. And she used something that these women knew how to do and created a business.
Yeah.
And she was saying that we needed work, of course, because we didn't have enough assistances, but we also, so that we can provide for our children, but also we needed to something to be busy with. Like she was like, we needed work to stay sane, yeah, because we had children to raise and we were going crazy if we would just sit and cry. And every time we would gather together, one of the women would start telling what they witnessed. Some of them witnessed their children being shot in front of their eyes. So she was like, I couldn't just handle hearing that anymore. And if I would go crazy, then I would have lose my children. So she was like, it yeah, was about economical reasons, but it was also about raising our children and being able to stay sane. And for me, that's in such a difficult situation, I think she was strong and smart at the same time to think like that and be able to continue. Because last year on March 8th, she opened a factory, and now she's in like a bigger factory. She's employing many more women, yeah, men as well. And she's exporting in Germany, Switzerland, in US. I don't know if she's exporting in UK yet, but if she doesn't, I'm sure she will very soon.
Well, I hope she does to Ireland as well, because I want to taste some of that particular spread. But yeah,
it's really good.
It did strike me. I mean, you obviously had to go back to your homeland, to Kosovo, to make this film, Blertha. That must have been a very emotional journey for you, and being up in the hills and in these small villages. I know, as you said, the actual village itself is destroyed, but you filmed in a village nearby. What was that experience like for you?
It is the same year I met Fahri, then we somehow also decided to come back and live in Kosovo. I mean, searching through all of this, it was a lot of digging deep into my own emotions, what I have been through the war, and like thinking of my mom, my grandmother, as women, as very strong women, actually, because my grandmother also moved to the city with 8 children and without a husband. And for me, it was a lot of digging deep into our own emotions. And even while talking and working with Ülka Goshi, who was amazing to work with, we a lot of times talk about how has it been for us to like be women, to like be to have gone through the war. We both were teenagers during the war. So the whole process of like coming back and talking to people in Krušai Mall, and talking to forensic doctors who had a lot of experience with families who had lost the family members. It was a lot of really, really going back to war memories. And we thought we healed from it, but we realized that we didn't. So it was a lot of like, also for us, it was a lot about healing process while making this film. And in a way it helped us, but in a way we really realized how much we need to talk about it, and how much we need to like talk how we feel about everything that happened here, and be able to like deal with it.
Blertha, beautiful to speak with you this evening. It's not surprising to me that the film is the winner of 3 awards at the Sundance Film Festival: World Cinema Grand Jury Prize, the Audience Award for World Cinema, and the Directing Award for World Cinema. Thanks so much for sharing your film with us and for talking with us this evening.
Thank you so much. We're really excited that our film is being released in cinemas there.
That's Blertha Bascioli speaking to us about the film Hive, which opens here in Ireland at the IFI on Friday. If you're strolling around Dublin on Friday, March the 25th, or indeed Saturday, March the 26th, divert through Trinity College if you can, and you might find your way to the library, where you could have an opera experience with a difference. The Scorched Earth Trilogy is a collective name for 3 short filmed operas commissioned by Irish National Opera, with lyrics from John McElduff and music from Brian Irvine. The trilogy is labelled Street Art Operas for the End of the World, and the operas explore some of the most pressing social, political and human issues we face today. Each of the short films will be projected onto the walls of the Trinity Library. Attendees will be given headphones to enjoy the experience in a more intimate fashion, I suppose. Writer and director of the project, John McElduff, is with me now alongside soprano Megan O'Neill, who is cast as Teen Bear, a polar bear who has had to move to the city. Her habitat has been destroyed, no more snow, and there she builds a new life as a TikTok influencer. Delighted to have both Megan and John with me in studio this evening. John, when you see something street art operas for the end of the world, you think, oh, yeah, we're not in a good place, are we? It's quite unusual in some ways for opera to take on that kind of socio-political tone, or is it?
Well, I think it is in contemporary opera, yeah. Mm. We really wanted to investigate some of the things that are going on in the world and be part of that conversation. And we thought as one really good way of doing this is putting it out in the street. I mean, street art does this really well. Mm. You know, it's always talking about the things that we're talking about and making a point. And we thought, well, if we bring these two together, because opera brings emotions and it brings big music and it brings that experience, so you can get something really beautiful out of it.
Was it you that kind of made the comparison, something along the lines of, if Banksy could sing, this is what Banksy would be doing?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, that was the beginning. We'd done a couple of operas that popped up around the city of Dublin 4 or 5 years ago. And the Dublin City Council, Rory O'Queeve, who was there, had suggested that we make a film. And we thought, well, why don't we make a film that can be projected in the city? And it works in the same way. Anybody can see this. Anybody can get a set of headphones. You come across it as a surprise and you experience a bit of art as you're walking through the city.
And last night on the programme, Megan, I was speaking to the actor George Mackay, who plays a young man who has this species dysphoria. He believes he's a wolf. Now, you're bringing, it's not species dysphoria, but you are actually a polar bear. You're a teen bear in this particular opera, which is the second of the three operas. Won't Bring Back the Snow is the title. Maybe give us a sense of who your young or your teen bear is.
Yeah, so I am a bratty teenage polar bear who was rebelling against my dad and I wanted to be on TikTok making dances and he's so against it.
Well, sure, how would you make a living out of that, he's saying.
Exactly. I feel like it's so relatable to teenagers of today. And even like myself as a teenager, when I read the script first, like it brought me back to like being in my room, listening to pop music, not necessarily knowing what it was about, but my parents coming in, I'm like, gosh, you're so embarrassing. Like, leave me alone. I can make a career from this. But it's just like that sense of being rebellious and fun and just being young. Yeah.
Yeah. And let's actually have a listen to a clip because we get a sense of, it's Owen Gilhooly plays Daddy Bear in this. Should I call him Daddy Polar Bear or Daddy Bear? I'm not quite sure. But he's really, what are you at? Why will you not just settle down, do a bit of work, go to school and do your thing? And in the middle of this clip then we hear Teen Bear actually making a TikTok video for him to say, look, this is what I do. This is the way I make money. So get out of my way and let me make one. So this is a little excerpt from Won't Bring Back the Snow. First voice that you'll hear, that of Owen Gilhooly as Daddy Bear, and then Megan O'Neill coming in as Teen Bear later on.
But you
been missing out, dreaming about Bahamas, hats of bikini style identical Rihanna, sweats on you, all forgot daddy's good advice, nothing's gonna taste the same, now you have the
cold. Run beneath that bare skin.
Yes, in fact, the first voice clearly that you heard was that of Megan O'Neill. Owen Gilhooly has not transplaced himself into a soprano just yet. But then we hear him coming in the middle and that wonderful little TikTok section in the middle, almost like a mixture of rap and opera music in there, Megan. That's really what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, it was the rap and you might be able to talk a bit more about what it was about. But for me, like reading it again, it's like self-expression. It's like you're not always sure like what you're, you know, talking about or singing about, but gosh, you know how to portray it, you know. As a teenager, like that's how it felt when I was, you know, acting it out. But I was just saying before we came in that it was so interesting when I was auditioning for this, I had to send in like TikTok dances and it was just the funniest audition experience like I've ever had, like just to actually get the part, you know?
I can't imagine there are many operas, John, where the audition tape is, would you send us in a TikTok dance, please, and song, and we'll see if you're right for the part.
Well, that's definitely the first time we've done it. It was an interesting mix of work, and Brian, who's done the music in this, has done a really interesting job of, you know, being really orchestral. You can hear it. It's been recorded with, you know, a lot of Irish musicians from, you know, the concert orchestra, but then mixing in this rap and this other form of music and blending them together.
But as well, you know, Megan saying to us, you know, that the typical teenage thing is you might know why you're rebelling, but you're definitely going to rebel. What's been spoken about and what's been sung about in all three operas, hugely important to you, Won't Bring Back the Snow gives us a hint. They are living in the city. They can't live in their polar ice cap, on their polar ice cap anymore. You are addressing very serious topics here, John.
Oh, definitely. I mean, all of this is satire, you know, all of these pieces. I mean, the other piece, you know, which is called Trickle Down Economics, is a riff on, you know, the politicians who sign agreements who don't actually make any difference. And in this one, we have a group of four drunk politicians relieving themselves up against a wall in Davos after having signed the Great Agreement. And it was inspired by the celebrations I saw when they signed the Paris Agreement. And years later,
what are you celebrating?
They were celebrating this, and of course, good reason. 4 years later, nothing had been done, right. and the agreement that they had done was completely useless. And I thought, oh, this happens again and again and again, and it seemed a really interesting place to dive into and to be part of that conversation of that topic. You know, we can't trust politicians. What are we going to do? And it comes back to us and other ways of reacting to this.
And just from the singer side of things, Megan, your career, you want to move towards a career in opera. Do you feel when you're singing in an operatic situation that you have that same type of self-expression in one of the more traditional style operas as you would have in something like this, where you're given a chance to basically to rap in an operatic style?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like this was a lot of fun to do, but there's also like the more serious side, which is kind of in like the second part of our part, Won't Bring Back the Snow, where we share this moment where, like, you know, my mother has passed away, you know, we're missing her, the snow is gone out of our habitat and we're left with nothing. And I suppose, like, so it's all fun and games until, you know, you actually look into the situation. It's like there's so many more serious things happening right now. So I feel like the second part of this is where I could really express that more serious side where, you know, everything is taken off you. And I was actually reading about polar bears in general, and like within the next 75 years, like polar bears could be extinct. So I feel like that's so serious. So it's a really interesting way of showing this is funny, you know, polar bears doing TikTok, but like actually this is like a real life situation. So it felt like a reality for me. And it kind of woke me up a little bit actually that like this is real, like climate change, global warming is happening. You know?
And the process of making the opera, in you recorded the music, I think, separately in Windmill Lane, and then the filming process itself, was that very different from the on stage type of process of putting forward an opera?
Yeah, it's so different. So it was like a really big learning curve for me, like to just have to, you know, mime over a track and record everything separately. But I suppose it also gives you more room to focus on the acting and like, you know, because you're not actually physically singing. But the funny thing is, like a week after I did this opera, I went and did another film opera where it was the same kind of thing where you're singing and then you record it and then you do the acting separately. So I feel like this kind of form is becoming more popular where, you know, you record the singing and stuff first and then turn it into a film, which I think is incredible. Like this was one of the most amazing projects I've ever worked on. Like I thought it was just amazing.
Yeah, yeah. We give out lots, John, about lockdown, but there are some things that have come out of lockdown that perhaps are useful in terms of quite simply expressing things in a really, with the way Megan has just told us, this idea of that you can actually concentrate on the acting in the filming part of it. But I think part of your thinking there too was, yourself and Brian Irvine and the composer here, was that you give people headphones so that it's quite an intimate experience, in even though it's a big up on a big screen, screened up onto a wall, you were looking for something more intimate than that in terms of what they're listening to.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, the strength, I think, of this experience is that you can see it on a big wall. It's like watching the cinema, but you have a really intimate listening experience. And the music, as you can hear, is a full-on orchestral piece of work. But what's interesting is in this way of watching it and this way of experiencing it, a lot of people don't even realize they're listening to opera.
Mm.
They catch the thing. They have a sort of a novel and interesting experience. And so they have none of the, the ideas. Sometimes people think, well, I don't listen to opera. I wouldn't like opera. I wouldn't like that type of music. But in seeing it and experiencing it this way, you just experience an incredible musical moment.
Yes, and they're 10-minute works. So it's not that you're asking people who might feel intimidated to go in and sit in an opera house or a theatre for 2.5 hours and think, well, that's a big commitment. 10 minutes is not a big commitment.
Exactly. Ten minutes is optimum for opera, I'd have to say.
Let's have a listen to something from the third part here. And this is an opera called Revival, because the trickle-down economics part of it, there's a bleakness in that as well. But when we get to the revival part, there seems a little sense of hope creeping in here, John, I'm glad to say.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, this piece is inspired by a philosopher called Bruno Latour, who writes a lot on environmental issues. And whenever I came across this quote, which talks about ways that we as humanity can move forward, and his use of words, thinking, he wasn't using a very bombastic way of thinking that we need to change the world. He was talking about our subtleness, our cautiousness, our revival, our contemplation, our hesitation. And these are the things as humans that are going to save us.
Yeah, and the music that we hear here, is it a children's chorus that is performing here?
It is indeed, yeah. It's a group of children that we put together from around Dublin, and they sing this piece and they perform in it. And it's as an image, it's become more current. It's an image we see a lot in street art, which is young children with gas masks on, and they're sowing seeds and pouring water from watering cans and creating then a revival. Mm. And an ecological revival of greenness.
Well, the future is in that. It's up to us, the other generation, to hand on a future. But the future is in the hands of mega generation, indeed the younger children that we're hearing in this. I really love this kind of choral sound that we're about to hear. This is from Revival, from the INO's current project. Saying, I mean, even just when those children's voices come in, obviously it starts with the solo voice and then the chorus of children's voices comes in. Megan, you were saying as we were listening to that, Megan Lee is one of the singers from one of the other operas in this INO series that we're speaking about this evening. You hadn't heard the children's chorus before, Megan. I found it very moving, I must say.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, I haven't heard this or the first section, so I'm also equally excited to go to see it. But like, I think there's something so beautiful about a children's choir, a children's voice. It's just that vulnerability and innocence that like no other voice can really portray. So yeah, sounds beautiful.
And there is a sense, I mean, essentially when you hear a children's chorus like that, John, it gives that sense of some kind of hope. You were saying the lyrics here, is it that Latour, that French philosopher?
Yeah.
Is that basically using his words here, are you?
It was, yeah. I mean, I came across that quote and he has this list of words and it goes like this. He's talking about ways to move forward as humans. And he says, but, you know, we no longer there is no control and no all-powerful creator either, no more God than man, but there is care, scruple, cautiousness, attention, contemplation, hesitation, and revival.
Yeah.
And we created the song out of those words because those words seem to hold a lot of hope in them.
Sure.
And a fragile hope that really matched children's voices as well.
There's a children's link into your next project, I think, as well, isn't there, Megan? You're going to be you're starring this October, Wexford Opera Festival, the role of Cinderella. Is this composed by a 10-year-old girl?
Yeah, Alma Deutscher, I think is how you pronounce her name. Yeah, so she's very young. I mean, she's incredible. The way she's wrote this music, it's just so beautiful. But she kind of changes the idea of Cinderella. So I'll be playing the role of Cinderella. I'm really excited about it. But she portrays it as, you know, an opera house. And the evil stepmother is like the manager of the whole thing. And the stepsisters like steal her melody. And it's a different portrayal of Cinderella, but like incredible.
Yeah.
Like absolutely amazing. So yeah, really, really looking forward to that.
Well, I'm sure we might speak a little bit further about that when Wexford Festival Opera is getting close to its tip. But it sounds very exciting. She composed it 7 years ago when she was 10. Do you ever feel inadequate?
Yeah.
Alma Deutscher, I wonder what she's done in the meantime. My first opera at 10, what did she do in the intervening years? Thanks for telling us about that, Megan. Look forward to hearing more about it. And indeed, John McElduff, thanks for being in with us as well. John McElduff, the writer and director of the Scorched Earth trilogy, and soprano Megan O'Neill, one of the stars of the short film, playing the part of Teen Bear in the first of the operas, isn't it? It's the first one, yeah. Scorched Earth trilogy will be projected onto three walls of the library at Trinity College on the evenings of Friday, March the 25th and Saturday, March the 26th. You can find out more information and book tickets through the website, which is irishnationalopera.ie. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. The Wall of Sound was a phrase originally coined to describe the production style of Phil Spector. It's been applied elsewhere to the likes of My Bloody Valentine, but more recently, Wall of Sound has been used to describe the music of six-piece Dublin band Thumper. With a lineup of two drummers, three guitarists and a bass, they've been developing their sound over the last 6 years or so, and this Friday, they released their debut album called Delusions of Grandeur. Two of the band members have come into studio to talk to us in advance of that release. Before we begin, let's have a sample of that epic sound from the forthcoming Thumper album. This is the opening track called Fear of Art. Opening track there, Fear of Art, from the album Delusions of Grandeur, debut from Dublin band Thumper, and it will be released, the album, this Friday, March the 18th. With me in studio now, Oisin Leahy Furlong, vocalist and guitarist, and drummer Stevie Darcy. In fact, Oisin, you're one of three guitarists in the band. Obviously, the guitar sound was the whole starting point for the band, was it?
Yeah, well, you know, the early days, the really, really early days, the inception of this band was just me recording like really lo-fi tapes and like distributing them around Dublin under the name Thumper. And we started the project got booked for festivals. And so I just basically surrounded myself with as many human beings as I could because the thought kind of terrified me a little bit. But then, yeah, down the line, I don't know, it was just sort of a formula that worked, especially with the double drums, it sort of balances everything out.
Yeah, that's not very unusual, since obviously, as I said, Stevie Darcy, one of the drummers with us this evening. How unusual is it? Maybe that's a better question, to have two drummers. You do see it the odd time, but it is quite unusual.
Yeah, you do see it, but I think it's bread and butter to us now. It's like, we've talked about it before, that we, you know, we've done one or two gigs where we didn't have the two kits and it just feels wrong. Now, you know, it's very, you're missing a big element. So, it feels normal to us now. It feels strange. I go see big production bands now and I'm like, oh, this feels a bit empty now because
there's only one drummer.
Yeah.
and I know, Oisin, we were talking a little bit about this before we came to where, even on the album itself, now, obviously, in the live situation, it's three guitarists, it's the bass and it's the two drummers. But on the album, some of the guitars are overlaid, so there must be times when there are five and six basically guitar parts here, or guitar parts.
Sean, if I told you how many guitar parts were in the song we just listened to, you might have to lie down.
How many? Go on. You might as well tell me.
I don't know.
But it's that many.
We're in double digits. Wow. 100%. Yeah.
So all three of you might be playing four different lines, but recorded at different times.
There's loads and loads. There's acoustic, there's synths, there's going on, there's... you know, the idea was, like, when this album was, when we started recording it in 2019, in the before times, as we call them, it was pretty meat and potatoes. Like, it wasn't that, it was more of an artifact of what we sounded like live. And, you know, then we were just going to go out on the road and tour it, and that was going to be it. But when we were kind of, when the live element was taken out of the equation, we sort of had to reconsider what our approach, and we kind of realized that it would have, the album would have to stand on its own two feet, because we had no idea when we were going to get to play this for anyone. So yeah, it's a long way around saying that, you know, we just basically gave ourselves free rein to do whatever the hell we wanted, because we might never have to play it live ever again. So.
And would you, if you could, would you have four, five, six guitarists live? Would you do that? Would you think about that?
Stevie, how many people are in our first ever gig? How many people were on stage?
I actually can't answer that because I don't know, because there were so many. We were just chatting about this the other day. We had a lineup, and we definitely had two drummers, maybe a percussionist, backing vocalist. There's definitely more than three guitars. Yeah. I think we love it. We love the madness of it, but like, I guess we just take it a bit more serious now, and it's more of a streamlined affair.
It did strike me, however, because I mean, most of the songs on the album we're talking about. Certainly 4, 5, 6, even 7.5, 8 minutes at times. You know, you're not necessarily going for a radio-friendly route here. You're looking for the big, it's the big gig where people are immersed in what you're doing. But right in the very middle then, track 5 on the album, which I would say Strychnine, I think you're calling it Strychnine is the title that you have on the track. Little acoustic number. It's only 2 minutes, but you hear a very different style in there. What brought that acoustic bit into the middle of the album?
I don't know. It was intuitive to us. I had a little demo of that song saved in my voice recordings on my phone as Thumper Mid LP. And I just found it one day and I was like, oh yeah, I will have that in the middle of the LP.
I will never say I'm sorry. I will never empathize. After all the words you swallowed, I will never wonder why. What's your strategy?
And it is like a little palate cleanser in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's certainly outside of our comfort zone if you talk about us as a live band transitioning into being comfortable in the studio setting, and we were trying to use tools that we don't normally use structurally and harmonically and all the rest, so yeah, it's been really nice. I mean, as I said, the album's out on Friday, but we've had the opportunity to hear people's reaction to it slowly. It's been really nice to hear people responding to that one.
Delusions of Grandeur, then, the title of the album, where did that come from, or whose idea was that? Are you getting ready for that one, Stevie?
I'm definitely not. I think that's an ushing question.
Well, as I said, the project started off very low stakes. Me in our old rehearsal room just recording stuff and putting it out really fast, and all these years down the line, as you say, like, two drummers, huge band, our first album's a double album because all the songs are a million hours long. It's kind of in reference to that. It's also, obviously, there's like lyrical connotations to it too, but I guess most of all it's probably just to get a jail free card to do whatever the hell we wanted on our album and not be told we're being too self-indulgent.
Yeah, because I suppose the wall of sound, you need to want it, really, don't you, as a listener?
It's kind of at odds with what's on trend now, I think, for bands that are like us, I suppose, it's the pursuit of something authentic. And honestly, it's just not the type of album that I like to listen to. Mm. It's certainly not the type of album that becomes like my favourite album, you know. And ironically, throwing caution to the winds with regards to that has meant that we made kind of the most authentic album to us that we could have done.
Yeah, well, you had to do what felt right for you. What about the writing process then with, you know, with a 6-member band? How does that work, Stevie?
Well, like Oisín mentioned earlier, like Thumper started off as Oisín's like solo project. And as the band kind of came into it, you know, it's a little more organic now. It's still like Oisín bringing definitely the meat and bones of the songs to us, and then we're kind of workshopping them in a little bit. But, you know, there's 2 tracks on the album, I think, that Al brought some music for. Alan, one of the guitarists, so he brought some music for Overbite and 25.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of, it's becoming a little more collaborative in that sense, definitely. Yeah. But yeah, we definitely like it's Oisín brings songs to us and we pound them out in the room for a couple of hours and get them into shape.
Well, funny enough that you mentioned Overbite. We're going to finish up with that. Which of you will set up Overbite for me?
Overbite?
Yeah.
Yeah, as Stevie said, it's probably one of the most cut and dry examples of us flipping the formula in terms of how we write together. Alan pretty much wrote all the music for that. And
this is Alan Dooley, the guitarist.
Alan Dooley, who plays guitar, yeah. And I wrote the lyrics. No, it's part of like a 3-piece long song that
at the very end of the album,
song, which we recorded as in one take as like one 20 minutes long piece of music, and then like split it into 3 for the record, if you know what I mean. Yeah, I'm fond of this one because it makes me feel good about the future of the band, you know. I know that the stuff that we've been working on since is much more in this vein, much more collaborative, and ultimately that's a part of the project that I enjoy the most.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks for coming in to talk to us. Best of luck with the album out this Friday, as I say. And here from the closing section of the album, a track called Overbite from Thumper's Delusions of Grandeur. That's a little taste of Overbite from Thumper, and speaking to me there were Oisín Leahy Furlong and Stevie Darcy from the band. Their debut album, Delusions of Grandeur is its title, will be released this Friday, March the 18th. There was originally supposed to be a launch party at Whelan's on Friday, but that has now been upgraded to the Grand Social Main Room on Saturday the 19th. But their website tells us that all original tickets are valid for the new date and there are extra ticket options available there. You can find out full details on the website, which is hellothumper.com.